The stories we tell are often much simpler than what actually happened. It's easy to streamline our narratives, to gloss over years of turmoil and heartache, the wrong turns and the false starts, the late nights and the pots of coffee, so that our stories have nice themes and they have clear beginnings and middles and ends. But life really doesn't seem to work that way. It's never so nice and neat. Rather, life seems to sprout up and grow branches and leaves and shoot off in 1,000 directions at once. And it leans ever so slowly toward the sun's warmth, intertwining with nearby lives, sharing and competing, harming and helping. So today, as we consider this story of the Israelites, just freed from Egyptian captivity, fashioning an idol, imagine with me what one of these odd offshooting narratives might have been like. The images came to her at the strangest times. They were flashes of color and movement. Bright green blades of grass bowing in the summer sun, deep red grapes stretching on their vines, crystalline waters bending sunlight over smooth stones. They were like memories, but not of any place she'd been. They had been implanted by her grandmother long ago around fires at night, placed there by her mother, singing old songs as she scraped together bits of grain for baking. Memories of hope, of a place that was promised to her and to her family, to all her people, long, long ago. At night, she'd lay on her straw mat, looking up through the holes in the thatch, and there she would see a star and wonder if that was her star, the one that Abraham had seen so long ago. In her dreams, she'd see the rolling hills spotted with goats and sheep, the olive trees and grapevines laden with fruit, golden fields whispering with grain, little streams where you could stretch out in the heat of the day, old sycamores you could climb up and catch the scent of wild honey and figs. But these hopes had withered long ago. When the news came through that Pharaoh was going to release them, she didn't believe it at first. Nobody believed it. They just went through the motions. They were gathering their things, cooking their last meal, not knowing whether they would live or they would die, just knowing they had to leave. Everyone knew it had to be a trick. And it was. At least it was a momentary lapse in judgment. It wasn't long until Pharaoh came running after them with his chariots and spears, but they made it by the skin of their teeth. And that was the first time it seemed real. They were finally on their way to that place of hope, the place where there was plenty and where they would be free. She looked up at the mustard hills wilting in the heat. This was not that place. This was not the promised land. The thundering mountain peered down at them like some snake ready to strike, just waiting for someone to provoke it, to slip and come too close so it could pierce them with fire. And their fearless leader, where was he? Up the mountain, hidden by smoke and clouds? Or had he already run down the other side and back off to his goats, leaving everyone else to fend for themselves? Were they just supposed to wait out here, eating that terrible excuse for bread that wouldn't even keep one night? Mommy, Mommy. Her daughter came running toward her, gold bracelets jangling on her arms. Look what Nana gave me, she squealed with delight. Oh, Mira, look at you. Scooped her up, and the little girl threw her arms around her mother's neck. She brushed the dark curls from Mira's face and looked into her shining eyes. What dreams had already taken root there? Would she know more than this endless sea of dust? Would she ever have a place to call her own? Look at my pretty things, she smiled, showing her mother the bracelets. They are very pretty, she said in the most truthful voice she could muster. These were supposed to be symbols of freedom, released from their slavery, gifts from their captors. But here, in this place, what good was gold? What point was freedom when there was no place to call home and nothing to hope for? Mira leaned back, looking up at the sky. And in her dark eyes, deep blues echoed from above, and memories of those dreams flooded back. She looked up, too. If you were to come to our house right now, you would most likely find on our coffee table half a mug of cold tea, a large bowl with 16 popcorn kernels, and two remotes. This is fairly standard. But underneath all of those things, you would notice something else, a puzzle, or at least the outer edges of a puzzle with the middle largely unfinished and a thin layer of random pieces scattered about. Luckily, we haven't let the puzzle get in the way. The puzzle was a fall break project, and it was my idea. It sounded like fun while we were standing in Michael's. The picture on the box showed a random assortment of household pets. Dogs and cats and a hamster and a guinea pig, even a bird, posing wildly for a selfie. It was a beautiful picture of pet solidarity. And I managed to put the hamster together, but that was as far as I got. Now, a puzzle sounds like a great idea until you open the box and you look inside and you see all those tiny pieces of irregularly shaped cardboard staring back at you, taunting you. And if you're like me, and you have been dealt the dual spiritual gifts of catastrophizing and procrastination, it's true. You may find yourself gently sobbing in the corner. Luckily, I haven't broken down yet. I've merely avoided the whole matter and have instead decided that the scattered pieces simply make the use of coasters unnecessary. Problem solved. Or is it? If left long enough, the jumbled pieces in front of us can turn into normalcy. They can sink into the fabric of the way things are. We can find other uses for these displaced pieces. Maybe they support our nightly cup of hot tea and they keep our coffee table from getting rings. Maybe they just sit quietly underneath our TV remotes. Maybe their presence makes us feel like we're doing something. And sure, maybe they cause a little inconvenience when the cat decides to bat them around the living room. But for the most part, life goes on. Now, I don't know about you, but I feel like every day our world gets a little bit more jumbled. Hurricanes and earthquakes and wildfires, immigration crackdowns and healthcare fiascos. Every day I'm waking up to news of some new injustice, some new group that has been attacked. And then I find that this is not a new injustice at all. This has been going on for years, or for decades, or for centuries even, and I have been oblivious. I have merely accepted that this mess is the way things are. And in my privilege, and in my fortunate geography, I don't have to think about all those displaced pieces. I can let them lie for now. Mira's cries slowly gathered and rolled into waves of sobs. Her mother rocked her back and forth, patting her back. "It's okay. Shh. It's okay." She didn't stop rocking as she examined arms, her legs, and her back, the red welts already beginning to turn purple where they had yanked the bracelets off of her. She grit her teeth and shut her eyes, still swaying, not sure if she was comforting her daughter or herself. And there were the greens and the blues, the waving fields of gold. She pushed them away. Shouting erupted. She looked up as the men pushed their way into a tent. After more shouts, they came out carrying handfuls of golden trinkets and rings. She kept bouncing Mira, stroking her head. "It's going to be okay." She repeated it over and over. "Going to be okay." But she knew it wasn't. As she looked down the row of tents, she could see a trail of disarray. Baskets overturned, shards of pottery, sandals splayed out in the sun. Here and there, bits of gold twinkling. No one foolhardy enough to retrieve them. Was this the way things were going to be? Weren't they supposed to be free now? Wasn't that the promise? Wasn't that the whole point? A land of plenty. A land of freedom. But for whom? A few weeks ago, I was in Charlotte for the Alliance of Baptists board meeting. And in one of our evening meals, I sat next to a guy named Greg. He and his wife, Helms, have led this intentional faith community. It's on the west side of Charlotte for over a decade now. It's called the QC Family Tree. QC stands for Queen City. That's Charlotte's nickname. And it's the nonprofit that they created to help their neighborhood. The QC Family Tree has purchased several houses in the neighborhood where Greg and Helms and their two boys and other folks in the community live. And over the years, while the surrounding areas have begun to gentrify, QC has worked hard to purchase these properties to keep the rents stable and affordable for folks who have been living in the area and maintaining the neighborhood for so long. They've started several small entrepreneurial projects to help provide jobs like their coffee shop. And in the summer, they run a camp for 70-plus kids and provide internships for college students and seminarians. They have a community garden to help fight food insecurity. And they've even started a West Side Community Listening Project to compile and preserve the oral histories of the neighborhood. Now, at the same meal, on my other side, was Taryn. Among other things, Taryn is an amazing vocalist who led us in worship during our meetings. She's also part of an art project that's focused on depression awareness. A photographer named Aaron Davis is compiling a powerful collection of photos of persons who deal with depression. The photos communicate a strength and a power in the midst of a struggle that is so often hidden away. Taryn was open and candid about her own struggle with depression, and she's featured in the collection too. Browsing through these photos is a beautiful journey and a reminder that you're not alone. See, when we see the mess that we're in, it's natural to want to look away. It's normal to shrink back into our isolation and to move back into the places that we know where we feel secure before our eyes had been opened. Especially when we realize that we're part of the problem. When we see that we have aided and abetted injustice. When we see that we are complicit in racial bigotry, when we see that our systems are built on the systematic oppression of persons of color, when we see that there is so much to change, what can we do? Do we go back to trust the old gods of our land? Do we choose the gods of the empire? Do we fight back with the same violent and belittling tactics? Do we weaponize morality and turn our neighbors into something less than human? Do we wring our hands because we can't amass the hordes of cash we need to buy the empire's soul for our side? Or do we just leave that golden calf there for a little longer? Because our leader is up on the mountain, and it's not safe. A trail of smoke slowly curled into the tent as if drawn to the lamplight. She hummed, trying to drown out the shouts and clangs of revelry echoing through the camp, but Mira was not going to sleep. Every scream, crash, and thud made her jump a little, still on edge from the earlier events of the day. And in the smoke, she saw flashes of that molten bull emerging from the fire, red, hot, and steaming. Men running around, half insane and drunk with power. Mira touched her hand. She looked down at the little girl, the lamplight waving in her eyes. She thought of the fields, the streams, the ever-rolling hills. "Let me tell you about a place," she said. And she told her daughter of the green slopes and the deep red fruit, of the cold water and the warm afternoon sun. She told her of the rich, dark earth and the bright, waving wheat. She told her of grassy hills to roll down and craggy trees to climb and swing on. She lay out all her memories of that place that she had never been, wove them all together like a blanket for her daughter to wrap up in. She added her own threads too, intertwining her golden hopes for a better life. Mira looked up at her mother. "Mommy, is that place real?" She looked out the cramped tent. She heard the tumult outside. She smelled the smoke. And she sat there for a long time. "Yes. Yes. It is a real place," she said. "Where is it?" she asked. "We will make it. Together." Last month, the Islamic Center of Louisville was vandalized with hate speech, spray painted across the facade. And just a few days later, over 1,000 people showed up to offer their support and paint over the graffiti. People from temples and synagogues and churches and schools took up paintbrushes, and everybody had the chance to paint a single brush stroke to cover the offense. Online, you can find a photo of students at the event with a banner that says, "Be a link in the chain of peace." What a beautiful showing of solidarity. And what a wonderful way to stand alongside sisters and brothers in their time of need. What a great way to say no to hatred and to bigotry with kindness and with love. And in this act, we get a glimpse of the promised land. A land that exists beyond thoughts and prayers. A land where there is enough room, enough food, enough shelter, enough work, and enough help, enough friends, enough hope. A land that is not pie in the sky by and by, a land that God makes here with us, Emmanuel. A land that springs up from the grassroots, generous and life-giving, born, not installed, received, not imposed, blessed, not inaugurated, inspired, not ratified. But it's not a given. It's not something that we get to sit by and wait on, because maybe some of us will be okay. Some people can't wait. Some people don't know if they're going to be able to stay in this country, the only country that they've ever known. And some people have lost their homes, their neighborhoods, and their cities to hurricanes and fires. Some people have lost their jobs as corporations seek higher yields. Some people have lost daughters and sons, friends and relatives to violence. Some people have been imprisoned without a fair trial. Some people have been assaulted because no one would speak up. Some people can't breathe, and nobody is listening. When God saw the Israelites were making an idol from the treasures of their exodus, he said an interesting thing to Moses. "Let me alone, so that my wrath may burn hot against them." Let me alone. It's like God can't bear to do it with Moses watching. Or God is asking Moses for consent. Or maybe God is just inviting Moses to join in this relationship. The very relationship that the Israelites are trying to avoid by casting their God into gold. And Moses jumps in. He argues, he challenges, he pleads their case before God. And God changes. God is inviting us to the table to join in the conversation. God is inviting us to be brave, to look at the mess, to take a piece of this puzzle, to make this place a little more like the promised land, to make our peace a little more just, more fair, more friendly, more respectful, and more welcoming. So who are we following? Are we following the golden God of our own creation? That golden God made in the fires of fear? A golden God that says there is not enough? A golden God says that we can make things great like they used to be? A golden God that only follows where the empire leads it. a golden God that cannot hear, cannot feel, cannot understand or call forth our better angels, a golden God that cannot see the way to the promised land. It's not the powerful and the privileged who can lead us to this land of promise. No, the last will be first, and the first will be last. The last and least know the way because they have felt the weight of oppression on their shoulders. They have carried the burden of unemployment. They have felt the pangs of hunger. They have known the exhaustion of three jobs to make ends meet. They have borne the insults, the injustice, and the blindness of the privileged. The last and least know the way, and they have seen the promise. So don't be afraid. Jump in. Find your peace. Listen to those who know, and join God in this holy mess. Now I leave you with this glorious vision of Isaiah once more. On this mountain, the Lord of heavenly forces will prepare for all peoples a rich feast, a feast of choice wines, of select foods rich in flavor, of choice wines well refined. He will swallow up on this mountain the veil that is veiling all peoples, the shroud enshrouding all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The Lord God will wipe tears from every face. He will remove his people's disgrace from off the whole earth, for the Lord has spoken. They will say on that day, "Look, this is our God for whom we have waited, and he has saved us. This is the Lord for whom we have waited. Let's be glad and rejoice in his salvation." May it be so.